This is March 5th, 2017, and I'm going to address a phenomenon that only seems to have grown since the election in January, which is sort of a generalized anxiety, fear and anxiety that I've heard from quite a few people, and more than ever, I, as a teacher, having heard from people, the fear is what's going to happen now. That with the new administration, the threat to our civil liberties and a lot of other things. I want to try to avoid talking much about the perceived threat, because I think more important is to look at our response to it. But just this much, I'll say that I think there are good reasons for worry. I don't remember ever in my lifetime seeing so many worrisome signs basic rights, and that we have, I think most of us have taken for granted, being thrown into question, and with the power in the three parts of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, being all in the hands of one party, makes it even more worrisome. So I don't want to minimize the anxiety that people may feel. I don't want to dismiss it as just imaginary, because I don't think it is imaginary. I'm concerned about what's going to happen in the next 4 years. But now, leaving that aside, let's look at our response to that, because that's our job in Zen practice, is to not dwell on the externals, that is, the objects of our mental processes, not to look out there at them, at him and them, but to turn our attention back and look at the mind, at our responses. This is basic premise. So we can't change very much of our conditions and circumstances. The conditions right now are pretty stormy. They're pretty windy. If you think of wind as change, there's a lot of turbulence now that we're exposed to in our country and in the world. What can we do about our reaction to these things? I collected a bunch of mostly short articles that I've been filing over the last few years about fear and anxiety. Maybe we'll start with just a look at this phenomenon of fear and anxiety. Seems to be something unique to our species. I looked up in the dictionary this morning the words fear and anxiety, because in my mind they're always sort of the same, but they probably aren't quite the same. Fear, the dictionary said, is the general term for the anxiety and agitation felt at the presence of danger. Anxiety is a state of being uneasy, apprehensive, or worried about what may happen. Concern about a possible future event. I'm just going to use them interchangeably this morning. They don't seem different enough to worry about these distinctions. Although some say that fear is more of a specific kind of anxiety, fear of some object, something, whereas anxiety can be diffuse and generalized. But I don't want to get into all that. I went back to an article from 2014 in The New Yorker. It's a review of a book called My Age of Anxiety. The title of the article is The Prisoner of Stress: What Does Anxiety Mean? And it's a book. The author has been beset his whole life with really almost crippling anxiety, almost, because he was able to write this book called My Age of Anxiety. While I think of it, that's one point made in this review of the book, which is that anxiety is hard to distinguish clinically from depression, which can also be understood as a response to a perceived or imagined threat. So anxiety and depression, clinically, difficult to distinguish, and there are certain drugs that will help with both of them. And then the review of the book, talks about all different theories of anxiety. It says anxiety is the common feature of all neuroses. I've learned with the help of my psychologist wife that a lot of anxiety is biologically determined. That is, we can relieve it to an extent. In various ways, cognitive therapy and other ways. But there are certain people who are just more anxious than other people. I think this is important to acknowledge because I think people can sometimes see it as a failing, anxiety as a failing. But it is often a biochemical biochemically determined, and for people who do have a kind of a higher baseline of anxiety, they may better just learn ways of managing it than thinking it's bad and they want something you can just get rid of. This book, My Age of Anxiety, the author's name is Scott Stossel, Stossel. Just a little bit about him. As he grew up, he acquired phobias about public speaking, flying, fainting, heights, closed spaces, germs, vomiting, and, wait for it, cheese. and then the reviewer here says that Stossel thinks that there is a metaphysics of anxiety. To grapple with and understand anxiety, he says, Stossel, is in some sense to grapple with and understand the human condition. And then the reviewer goes on to say, many people have made this claim, but it can mean different things. It can mean that human beings are creatures who care about the future. And so hoping for good outcomes and worrying about bad ones comes with membership in the human species. This is roughly the existential view. Uh, dogs and cats, the reviewer says, dogs and cats presumably do not know this feeling. Anxiety is the price tag on human freedom. And that's one way of understanding it, is choice, being confronted in a very basic existential way with choice. And the most important choice we can make, and I'll say a little more about this later, is how to use our attention. Whether we want to dwell on these perceived threats to us or not. That's the choice when it all comes down to, from a Zen perspective. It also says in this review, anxiety is the common feature of all neuroses. And here's, I found quite interesting, I have to share it with you. Charles Darwin suffered from a social anxiety that frequently made it impossible for him to leave his house. Let me back up a second before I get to these interesting examples. The reviewer says, one way in which anxiety differs from depression is that anxious people are often not dysfunctional. That anxiety can be harnessed achieve great things. And then he gives these examples. Charles Darwin suffered from a social anxiety that frequently made it impossible for him to leave his house. Laurence Olivier and Hugh Grant had stage fright. Laurence Olivier, I've read in more than one source, had the stage hands. Whenever he was performing on stage, would have stage hands, have a bucket on hand because he always threw up before going out on stage. About Hugh Grant, it said, Grant has said more than once that he was going to stop making movies. Richard Burton could not bear to be in a room where there was honey. Joan Baez and Matt Lauer have come out as they share a dread of vomiting. I have a dread of pronouncing that word. On the other hand, Bill Russell, the star center of the Boston Celtics and one of the most dominant athletes in the era of professional sports, vomited before almost every game he played in. On nights he didn't, his teammates worried that they would lose. I'm hoping to normalize anxiety for people, because I used to think that there was something wrong with you if you had anxiety. You know, if you're practicing Zen, then you shouldn't have anxiety. Nonsense. It's a perfectly normal thing. It's the extent of it, the intensity of it, that is important in terms of our functioning, and again, what we do with it. The most important thing I learned when I did some psychotherapy was to be aware of your anxiety as it's coming up. This is pure meditation wisdom, is to be aware of what's going on, not just in the mind but in the body. So to recognize anxiety, and it has physical signs, getting a catch in the throat, becoming hoarse, noticing the heartbeat accelerating, the palms getting wet. The one time in my life that I had wet palms was I had been in Europe. This is when I was 20 years old, And I had made the rounds with my backpack and ended up in these two big cavernous hashish houses in Amsterdam, Paradiso and Fantasia. And had been persuaded to buy some hashish and brought it back. And as I very cleverly, I thought, after wrapping it in aluminum foil, had put it in the film compartment of my camera. And when I approached the customs agent, well, no, as the plane was descending into the Detroit airport, I was stunned to see that my hands were wet, because I wasn't aware of what I was feeling, of course. That's another thing to be aware of for some of us, is being cut off from our feelings. But I couldn't deny that my hands were wet. And then when I got into customs and approached the guy and he poked around through my bag, I had my camera hanging from a strap around my neck. I thought I would throw him off. He wouldn't. And sure enough, I got through. A year later, I wasn't so lucky. But yeah, to learn these different things. Notice. That's awareness. Notice how your body reacts in different circumstances. And then once you've noticed that you're anxious, then there's something that's a big step. And one source of anxiety is suppressing anger. That's the one that I learned in therapy, is that if we're not in touch with our anger, this can result in anxiety, and that's two. I've been talking about anger in the past. I've talked about how important it is to notice the anger, and it's the same way. You notice signs of anger, which are mostly signs of the same as signs of anxiety. There's another article I came across. From 2012, it's this column in the New York Times called Gray Matter, and it's called Inside the Mind of Worry. And it reports on research by Paul Slovak of the University of Oregon and Baruch Fishhoff of Carnegie Mellon, identifying reasons that might that something might feel more or less scary than mere reason might suppose. So they talk about how we just naturally weigh the risks and benefits of things, and they what they found was that a risk imposed upon a person feels scarier than the same risk if taken voluntarily. They were relating a lot of this to the fear of vaccinations. So a risk imposed upon a person feels scarier than the same risk if taken voluntarily. So I'm relating this now to the changes that have taken place in the 6 weeks since in the inauguration. A risk perception also depends on trust. A risk created by a source you don't trust will feel scarier. And third, risks that are human-made evoke more worry than risks that are natural. All three of these, I think, would contribute to the anxiety out there about these changes in government. Anxiety can also be experienced as excitement for those lucky enough to experience it that way. but underneath the excitement really is anxiety. I remember going to Sesshin in those early years. I would feel a certain dread a week before the Sesshin was to start, and then that would sort of build up until Tuesday. It was very, very consistent, very predictable. And then on Tuesday, it would flip to excitement, like going to battle. It must be somewhat similar to going to battle. You see remember these images of soldiers in World War I during the trench warfare of being coaxed by their commanding officers to charge out of the trenches and go across into withering machine gun fire and just hollering and screaming and at an earlier age on horseback, the same thing, this shouting to galvanize one's courage. And that's the kind of excitement based on growing out of fear. And then there's another article I came across. This was in Newsweek from even longer ago, 6 years ago, called High on Anxiety. And it says that many anxious people are bound and determined to cultivate anxiety, though not always consciously. The reason, studies suggest, is that for some people, anxiety boosts cognitive performance, while for others, it actually feels comforting, which is so counterintuitive. But later in the article, they say that it's because it's familiar. It becomes, for people for whom anxiety is familiar, it's kind of a known place. The author says some people get addicted to feeling anxious because that's the state that they've always known. If they feel a sense of calm, they get bored. They feel empty inside. They want to feel anxious, though not consciously, probably. So that's another thing for people who find themselves in a kind of a steady state of dread or anxiety, is just to ask yourself, to what extent you're using this to avoid what is the alternative, which is the void. All of these states, anxiety, fear, and others, can arise during Sesshin as a kind of a barrier to going one step further and experiencing real emptiness, the absence of thought. And that is more the existential understanding. And I would say that the more of the Zen understanding of anxiety is that, it's part of our being self-aware as members of the human species, and aware of our mortality. Doesn't it always come down to that fear of death? Who can prove that? But I suspect that underneath all anxiety is this self-consciousness. Consciousness of the self as mortal, as it's just a matter of time before we are to disappear. There's a rather lengthy passage here that I want to read from because it's just so speaks to this fundamental anxiety of being alive and aware as human beings. This is from a book by Edward Kanze. Doesn't say here which book, but this is what it says. According to the views elaborated by Scheler, Freud, Heidegger and Jaspers, there is in the core of our being a basic anxiety, a little empty hole, a little empty hole from which all other forms of anxiety and unease draw their strength. In its pure form, this anxiety is experienced only by people with an introspective and philosophical turn of mind, and even then only rarely. If one has never felt it oneself, no amount of explanation will convince. If one has felt it, one will never forget, however much one may try. It may come upon you when you have been asleep, withdrawn from the world, you wake up in the middle of the night and feel a kind of astonishment at being there, which then gives way to a fear and horror at the mere fact of being there. It is then that you catch yourself by yourself, just for a moment, against the background of a kind of nothingness all around you, and with a gnawing sense of your powerlessness, your utter helplessness in the face of this astonishing fact that you are there at all. Usually we avoid this experience as much as we possibly can because it is so shattering and painful. Usually I am very careful not to have myself by myself, but the I plus all sorts of other experiences. People who are busy all the time, who must always think of something, who must always be doing something, are incessantly running away from this experience of the basic or original anxiety. What we usually do is to lean and to rely on something else than this empty center of ourselves. The Buddhist contention is that we will never be at ease before we have overcome this basic anxiety, and that we can do that only by relying on nothing at all. Nothing at all. And what that really means is no thought. And that's what every Zen practice, whether the breath or koan or shikan taza, they're all ways of getting to us beyond thought into that nothing at all, which can be quite frightening the first time or the first few times that we approach it. I hear this from many people during sesshin. That's when it's most likely to happen, that we get beyond thought, who on the verge of getting completely beyond thought feel a fear, even a terror, and then go into full retreat back into thoughts. But then, if one ventures in, even just gingerly, little by little, you become accustomed to it, and it becomes more familiar, this world of no thought, and then the dread of it, the fear of it, which is really the fear of dying, of not being, then that fear. Subsides, and we become more comfortable in that realm of no thought, and that is the ultimate refuge and peace. The wonderful thing about anxiety experienced as excitement is that it's motivating. And this is the silver lining in these somewhat frightening flurry of executive orders that we've seen in the past 6 weeks, which is how it has roused so many people to action. And people who find themselves slipping too deeply into anxiety and dread should balance that feeling with the awareness that there are a lot of us who are ready to go into action. There's a proverb, sometimes only a nightmare can wake one up. We're waking up. Our country is waking up from what you could say is a long, long, long slumber of consumer satisfaction, of consumer goods, and all of the many diversions and pleasures that we have been able to manufacture in this country. We're starting to snap out of it. I have a list here of bits of advice from Beatrice King, the granddaughter of Martin Luther King Jr. I'm going to read some of them because I think there are a lot of good ones here. Number one is use his name sparingly so as not to detract from the issues. That's what I've been trying to do in this show. Use his name sparingly. I believe that everyone, regardless of their beliefs, deserves the dignity of being called by their name. However, this is a strategic tactic. While we are so focused on him, we are prone to neglect the questionable policies that threaten freedom, justice, and fairness advanced by the administration. That is, the policies advanced by the administration that threaten freedom, justice, and fairness. Number two, remember, this is a regime, and he's not acting alone. That's very important. Don't demonize anyone. Recognize that he got there with a hell of a lot of support and is staying there even now with some complicity or collaboration with his party, which I also won't mention. Number three, do not argue with those who support him and his policies. It doesn't work. And this is also basic, ancient Buddhist advice, is that arguing has little chance of changing the other person's mind. Arguing, especially these days, arguing on the basis of facts? Good luck. Number four, focus on his policies, not his appearance and mental state. Yeah, this was something that I felt was a big mistake during the campaign. Often hilarious ways that people were characterizing him based on his appearance and state. But it's the policies. Five, keep your message positive. Those who oppose peace and justice want the country to be angry and fearful, because this is the soil from which their darkest policies will grow. Well, that's where we have to take responsibility for our fears and not have that as the basis of our responses. Find a way to emphasize the positive. Number six, no more helpless, hopeless talk. Number seven is, I think, very interesting. And I think profound, support artists and the arts. Number eight, be careful not to spread fake news. Check it. Number nine, take care of yourselves. And 10, resist. Then she elaborates, keep demonstrations peaceful. In the words of John Lennon, when it gets down to having to use violence, then you are playing the system's game. The establishment will irritate you, pull your beard, flick your face to make you fight, because once they've got you violent, then they know how to handle you. The only thing they don't know how to handle is nonviolence and humor. When you post or talk about him, don't assign his actions to him. Assign them to the Republican administration or the Republicans. This will have several effects. The Republican legislators will either have to take responsibility for their association with him or stand up for what some of them don't like. He will not get the focus of attention he craves. Republican representatives will become very concerned about their re-elections. And that is, I think, our ultimate hope, is that through enough vigorous feedback to our representatives, Democrat or Republican, that this can bring some sense to them and compensate for the complete one-sidedness of the power now in these three branches of government. Well, two so far, the executive and the legislative, both houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives. But it's just a matter of time, isn't it, before the Supreme Court also tips back to, I guess, what it was earlier. Now, Zen offers the ultimate weapon against anxiety, which is attention. Where are you placing your attention? When you're in a state of fear, anxiety, or dread, where is your attention? Most likely, it's on him or them, and not on what is beyond him and them. That is your practice. So I would say, first of all, to people who are losing sleep or just in their daytime hours feeling this anxiety, how much sitting are you doing? This sitting is the secret, the elixir, the magical elixir, is we have a choice as to where to direct our attention. Use that choice. Don't dwell in thoughts or in news that makes you more fearful. I think it's, we need to be aware of what's going on, but aware means how much news do you have to be devouring day in and day out. If you know that it's making you more fearful, then cut it out. You're not going to be that much good to people if you're in a state of constant dread. And you won't be if you're using the mind the way we know it can be used, employing it to focus on what is right here, not what we're hearing through the media. How much sitting are you doing? And then, even if you're sitting a lot, you still have a kind of a basic level of anxiety, you're an anxious person, understand that there are beneficial aspects of anxiety. It focuses the mind. It prepares the body for action. In one of these articles, it says, when it said that, it said, in extreme cases, by evacuating the bowels. This is our biology. It focuses the mind and prepares the body for action. And action is what we have available to us still with our civil liberties, our freedom of speech. As long as we have it, let's use it. Thomas Jefferson said, "The price of liberty is eternal vigilance." Vigilance starts with awareness. Vigilance means awareness, noticing things out there and things in here, the mind, the body. And that awareness we develop through daily sitting. All right, our time is not up, but we'll stop and say the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless mind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates.